and welcome back to Step Into the Past, the podcast where we take you back in time to explore the stories of our ancestors with research brought to you by Find My Past. In each episode, we explore the stories of historical lives and their connection to places around the UK. And we go forward in time to speak to their descendants to find out the impact and the legacy of those stories today. I'm Professor Susanna Lipscomb, historian, author, and TV presenter, and I've always been fascinated by the stories of people from the past. I'm particularly interested in getting at the mysteries of family history and how we can piece them together using historical records. And we'll be doing plenty of that in this episode. In today's episode, we've come to Birmingham to explore a story that closely intertwines with the industrial, social, and religious history of the city. The family stories today showcase what life would have been like for the thousands of industrial workers who lived here, mostly in back-to-backs, poor quality housing that was built back-to-back around a shared courtyard with basic facilities for the surrounding families. Today, we have only one remaining example, this one here, preserved by the National Trust at the corner of Ing Street and Hurst Street. Keep listening as we explore the story of these lost urban slums and discover the realities of back-to-back living with one of those people's descendants. Jan Daniels, welcome to Step Thank Into you. The Past. We're going to be talking about your family, your ancestors, who were among many thousands of people who lived in Birmingham in its age of industrialisation. And what do you know about their history?
I just know that I think many of them were poor, working class people. Many, as far as I'm aware, lived in back-to-back houses in quite unpleasant conditions, I think. And beyond that, I know names and places, but not a lot about the sorts of lives they might have led.
We're going to talk about the family line that you know least about.
Okay.
So we're going to follow your paternal side back to the early 19th century.
Paternal, okay.
And we're going to be meeting the Phillips, the Baileys and the Sharrods.
Wow. Oh, wow. This is better than I expected.
We're going to start with your three times great-grandparents.
Yeah.
James and Mary Ann Phillips.
Okay.
And the reason we're here at this grand Baroque church... This is St. Philip's, Birmingham Cathedral, as it now is.
Yeah.
But back in the early 19th century, this was a parish church. But it the grand parish church. You can imagine the sort of fine, fancy people of Birmingham coming here to be seen. But back when this was a parish church, because it only became a cathedral in 1905, James Phillips and Mary Ann Green were married here.
Okay.
On the 8th of April, 1824.
And you found the record?
Mm-hmm. We've got the record. In fact, what's very interesting, actually, is we've got the witnesses. And one of the witnesses is Anne Green. So presumably mother or sister. Mm-hmm. And she signs her name with an X.
Yeah.
She doesn't write. But James Phillips can sign his name.
Oh, really? So you found... I can't believe you found a record for here.
For here? For here.
So why would they marry here?
Well, this is part of the mystery. This is one of the things we've got to talk about. So let me tell you about them first of all. So James Phillips was a broker, and a broker at this time essentially someone who bought and sold stuff. So he's a furniture broker and then a tool broker and an ironmonger along the way.
Mm.
And my notes said Mary Ann didn't work. I think we'll come to see that she did. But now there's an 18-year gap between them. By 1841, by the census of 1841, they have 8 children. So let me just tell you their names. They're between 15 years old and 2 months old at that stage.
Wow.
Catherine, Sarah, Charles, Mary, Jane, Anne, Joseph and Susanna.
Okay.
Do you recognise any of those names?
Is it Charles who might be my second great-grandfather?
Yes.
I think.
Yes,
yeah?
You're cautioning on quick. Exactly, yeah. That's right.
Because he is some sort of broker as well, I think.
That's right.
I think.
That's right. Yeah. Okay, so they marry here, as we said, the smart church, the place to be seen. But then when we look at all those children, Charles and his siblings have their births recorded, not baptism records, but their births recorded in 1840 at Cannon Street Baptist Church on what's now Corporation Street. What we what we suspect is mm-hmm. that your family were nonconformists.
Okay.
The Church of England in the early 19th century was the great edifice. Mm-hmm. It's the, you know, it's the established church. But it also was quite, how do I put it? It's quite interested in social mm-hmm. hierarchy being maintained.
Okay.
And quite a lot yeah. of people were interested in social reform mm-hmm. or otherwise are inclining towards the nonconformist faith, like Baptists right. and Methodists and the Quakers.
And is Birmingham a place where that became,
yeah.
Yes. Okay.
I mean, actually, across the industrial towns, generally speaking,
yeah.
it's true. Out of a population of 18 million in 1851, we know only 5 million were going to the Church of England.
Mm-hmm.
But they did get married here. So then they have yeah. their children, their yeah. births registered in 1840. And
yeah.
so before the legislation of 1837, if yeah. you were a Baptist, because you didn't, Baptists didn't believe in child infant mm-hmm. baptism, that meant the birth often went unrecorded.
Oh, okay. So is this why they were all baptised? Because I remember finding Charles's, what I thought was his baptism record. Yeah. And is he about 12?
So it's not probably not a baptism record. It's probably just a record of his birth.
Oh,
and it
okay.
probably is done then in 1840 because the legislation has been in place for 3 years by mm-hmm. that point. And it's got to the point where you could be fined. If
oh,
the
wow.
information, yeah. if you haven't registered the information.
Yeah.
And so the information has all been registered.
Right.
And it's also possible by that point for nonconformists, including Baptists, to offer civil registrations at their mm-hmm. place of worship.
Okay.
So that's why we see them all together.
Right.
And he's
and at
he's
the age.
At that age.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. And am I right, if, you know, not only would they have worked hard for a living, presumably they were essential to the economy.
Absolutely essential to the economy. The
yeah.
entire Industrial Revolution was built on the backs of people like your ancestors.
And yet history doesn't often focus on them.
History doesn't often focus on them because we don't have the records that tell us details of their lives. In many cases, because they were illiterate.
Okay, yeah.
So it's about what survives, you know. And also, they didn't have the leisure to write things down. They didn't have the time.
Sure, yeah.
You know, your three times great-grandmother had her hands full with her eight children, so she
right.
wasn't sitting down to write about the experience
no,
of looking
no.
after them. She was
no.
getting on with it.
It's mind-blowing, actually, isn't it, when you think of what their context might have been like. And I say might, because it's hard to imagine. You know, just, you know, you can start to try and imagine, but it's hard to be them.
We're going to go from here to an area where they lived, which looked rather different at the time.
Okay.
Let's go.
I'm intrigued where we're heading.
So the area we're in, you can see we're walking past some nice 19th century brick. But on the other side, we've got the Taj Mahal,
yeah.
established 1962, which is a bit of a clue. Not the Taj Mahal bit, but because what we've got here is a new building from the 60s, early 60s or even late 50s, after this area was cleared. So in the 1930s, many of the back-to-backs were declared unsanitary.
Yes.
But people were living in them up until the 1960s. And then in the 60s into the 70s, there was this big, what they called slum clearance
yes.
program. But this area, in other words, would all have been back-to-backs.
Oh, wow.
With pubs and shops and
yep.
factories around them. And we're just approaching Dudley Street.
Dudley. Dudley Street.
Yeah. You've got the pronunciation down there. I want to talk to you a bit more about James and Marianne's family. So you know that they had eight children.
Yeah.
And if we look at the lives of those children, it gives us, I think, quite a vivid picture of mm-hmm. what life was like then. So the first one was Catherine. Catherine got married in 1844 when she was 18 years old.
Goodness.
And she married Thomas Field, who was a chandler, which is to say he's a dealer, much like her father had been at part of the time, but in household items. So soap
okay.
and candles, paint, oil, groceries, that sort of thing. A year after she married, her sister Sarah died. And her sister Sarah was 19 when she died. So therefore, by a process of deduction, we can tell that Catherine and Sarah were twins.
OSA. Right, okay. I hadn't realised that either.
And a few months later, their younger sister, Jane, died, who was only 13.
Wow.
And so we don't know what they died of. But what I think we can learn from this is that this is a period of high mortality. This is what's, they're known as the Hungry 40s, the 1840s. It's a time of cholera, epidemic disease, the Irish potato famine, and just the circumstances of living in an industrializing city in the 1840s were really, really tough. Now, both children, both, well, they're not children, I suppose, 19 and 13, one was a child, were buried at St. Philip's, where we've just come from. So we've got this strange thing where the couple were married at St. Philip's. They then have the births registered at Cannon Street Baptist Church, and then they bury their daughters at St. Philip's. Why do you think that might be?
I honestly don't know. Would it be normal for working class people to be buried there as well or not?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, it was a parish church at the time, so people living in the parish would be buried there.
Yeah.
And maybe there was something comforting or, you know, reassuring in that sense that we've put them, we've done it properly.
Absolutely.
You know, we've buried them, we've done it properly, we've done good right by them, we've put them in the best possible place we can.
Yes.
There are other changes in the household as well. By 1851, their daughter Mary has become a dressmaker, and Joseph has followed his father's footsteps of becoming a broker. And by the census of 1871, we discover that, James has died, the father. So Mary Anna is at this point a 70-year-old widow, and she's listed as the head of the house. And she's living at that time with her daughters Anne and Susanna and a granddaughter called Jane Field, so Catherine's daughter. Yeah. And this is where it's very interesting, because Anne, Susanna and Jane are all dressmakers at that time. But Mary Anne has an occupation listed as well. You know, I said earlier, it says she doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she's already brought up eight children, so she's done an awful lot of work.
Yeah, absolutely.
But she's now listed as a tool dealer.
Oh, wow.
At 70.
Right.
So for the last 8 years of her life, before she dies in 1879, she has taken on her husband's profession.
And was that unusual at the time?
It's not unusual at all. And actually, what I think it actually indicates is that we shouldn't believe that silent space where it says occupation next to woman. Because probably what she was doing is helping her husband all
the
time.
Wow.
All of those years.
Yeah.
She's the unpaid labour in the house, in the business. And then in 1871, she takes it on in her own name.
And only on her husband's death is she recognised.
Exactly.
Shocking, actually, isn't it?
But pretty standard throughout history.
Yeah.
And what's amazing also is that this business savvy streak continues with those daughters.
Okay.
And with her granddaughter. So fast forward to the next census, 1881, the three women are living together and they have established a business as ironmongers.
Oh, wow.
So Anne is sort of head honcho and the retail ironmonger, and the others are listed as assistants.
Goodness
and
me.
Isn't that amazing? It's quite unusual for the time to have a business run by three women.
And would that be from the skills, the knowledge they've learnt from their father,
exactly.
presumably?
Wow. From their father and mother, we now know.
So they have that sort of the title, the kudos in their own right now.
Exactly.
Wow. I'm proud of them, actually, to
hear
that.
Absolutely.
Very proud of them. Yeah. Which presumably gives them a better standard of living as well.
Exactly.
Wonderful.
We're going to talk a bit more now about their brother, Charles.
Okay.
Who is your two times great-grandfather. Mm-hmm. Now, we are standing on Essex Street.
Okay.
Let's just take a walk. So Essex Street is where Charles was born.
Oh, okay. Actually born here.
Actually born in 1828.
Goodness me.
And we know, of course, that we have his birth registered in 1840 at that Baptist church. And by the time he's 25 years old, we know that he's living with his parents at Horse Fair, a location that no longer survives.
Yeah.
He doesn't have an occupation listed. I think it's really important to note that that doesn't probably mean he doesn't have an occupation, given what we know about their financial precarity.
Yeah.
I'm sure he does have one, but it's not listed for some reason.
Yeah.
And then he meets Hannah Maria Smith. Now, I was going to say he marries, but actually, they don't do things in quite that order. So by this point, he's working as a master locksmith. And they have four children. And then in 56, they get married.
Oh, really? So they do actually get married?
They do get married.
Because I've never found a marriage record.
They get married in Staffordshire. And the reason you haven't found the record is because of names.
Okay.
So he is Charles James Phillips, but sometimes he uses James Charles Phillips.
Yes, and I'd found that inconsistency, I thought it was.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, or I wonder, so his father's called James. Maybe he moves it forward. Maybe he prefers the name. He wants to use his father's name. Anyway, so they go on to have another two children, Sarah. And then we have Clara, born in 1859. And so, for example, on Clara's birth certificate, he puts his name as James. And the other thing I should say is, again, we have here with his wife, Hannah Maria Smith, when they get married, she signs it with a mark. She makes a mark. So she can't read or write.
And can Charles?
But Charles signs it.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah. By 1861, we can pick up the family, Charles and Hannah Maria and their children, in Walsall, in Staffordshire. And at that time, he's working as a marine store dealer. Now, I think you were a bit curious about
that. I was, because to me, I'm thinking we're not anywhere near marine environments, unless the canals count in any way.
Originally, a marine store dealer was to do with looking after the needs of mariners.
Okay.
So it's a bit like being a broker. It's a kind of dealer in stuff. In this case, waste stuff. So bunting and cordage and rags and timber and metal and all that sort of stuff. So there was a bit of repairing and mending. Mm-hmm. But generally speaking, he's a dealer in scrap materials. Sort of rag and bone man.
I was going to say, is it rag and bone man stuff?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. But without the barrows and in a fixed setting.
In a fixed setting.
Okay.
So what's interesting in this census is that he is listed as James Charles, as he'd been listed at Clara's birth in 1859. Yeah. But we know it's him because we've got Hannah Maria, formerly Smith. So we've got an exact match
on
her. I think he'd been using the name James for quite a while, because on the 10th of April 1858, we have the Staffordshire Advertiser telling us that Charles had been charged with taking possession of stolen goods, knowing them to be stolen. And the goods were stolen nails, £22.5 worth, which added up to the value of 7 shillings and 6p.
Which would be a lot then, presumably.
A day's wages for a skilled labourer.
Wow.
Skilled tradesman even, actually.
Yeah.
So, there's more detail in the Walsall Free Press and Advertiser, which gives us some information. So apparently a lad had gone to him, a chap called Henry Reeves, and had tried to sell him an iron mortar earlier that day. And being an upstanding man, by all accounts, he'd said, no, I'm not going to buy that. I'm going to find out if your father-in-law really wants to sell that.
Okay.
But that lad came back later with these nails. Mm-hmm. And he waited to see them, and then he did buy them. So I think he was slightly worn down by the process of this lad keep approaching. And they turned out to belong to the lad's employer.
Wow.
And in the end, both the lad, Henry Reeve, and Charles, or James, were found guilty, but the sentence was deferred.
Right.
And it says in the paper, providing the impression that the verdict was contrary to evidence. In other words, they didn't believe that he actually had known they were stolen. Because that's the heart of the matter. Mm, you can receive stolen goods, but if you don't know they're stolen, you're not to blame.
And presumably in his line of work, he's going to see all sorts of things coming through the door.
Exactly. Yeah. Likely to be an occupational hazard. Who knows if it's going to happen again. But I wonder if that kind of slight brush with the law explains why that we see in the next census, 1871, they've returned to Birmingham. And this time he's working as a locksmith again. So he's abandoned the marine store dealing, and he's working alongside his son Vincent.
Yeah.
And his eldest son John is a modeller in the pottery industry.
Okay.
And his daughter, Sarah, who is 14, is a painter. Possibly of pottery, we don't know.
Okay, yes, yeah.
Clara, who's 11, is still at school. But can you imagine going out to work at 14?
Yeah, and sadly, because my parents, they both left school at 14. That was a school leaving age. They went and they went straight to work. So mum particularly would actually talk about being keen to leave school, you know, partly to earn her own wages, but actually to get out of school.
Yes.
Which is odd, knowing that people fought to have education.
Yes.
Yeah.
If you're enjoying Step Into the Past, I think you might like the National Trust podcast. You can explore over 130 episodes featuring immersive tales of history, nature, and adventure.
Now, in 1880, tragedy struck. Charles's wife, Hannah, died. She was only 49, and her condition is listed as general debility, which I think says a lot about the quality of life that they mm-hmm. have. To be debilitated to the point of death by 49 means you've lived a very hard life.
And that term, general debility, what's that actually mean in that context? Worn out.
Yeah. Goodness knows. I mean, generally speaking, if it was a cancer, they would list that. And we have points, you know, or a specific disease that's listed as well. So it is a bit of a vague and general catch-all. It conceals as much as it reveals, doesn't it?
But 49.
Yes.
That's young, shocking.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
So as a widower, he continues to live in Stafford Street, but now with his son Vincent and with mm-hmm. Vincent's wife and children. And additionally, with a 27-year-old charwoman who shares their house, who's called Emma Bellamy.
That's right. Now,
Does that ring a bell?
Yes, I know of her. Because, again, they are later listed as being married, but I have never found a marriage.
Well, they are married. By 1891, they have married.
What, really?
Despite this 25-year age gap. And they've gone on to have three children.
But they did actually marry.
They did actually marry. And then Charles died in 1901 when he was 73. And his cause of death, I mean, it's again, is slightly vague by standards of the time. It's syncope from anemia due to bleeding from the nose. It says natural causes.
Ah, yes.
So syncope is just a fancy word for fainting. And anemia with bleeding from the nose, or bleeding from the nose can be a symptom or a complication of untreated anemia. And anemia, of course, results from malnutrition.
Yes. Oh, okay.
And in, you know, poor nutrition, chronic diseases, infections.
Right, okay.
So again, it's another testament to the sort of life that they've lived.
I'm pretty sure it's Charles's inquest. Because I think there's an inquest held into his death.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a friend got the inquest info for me.
Yeah.
I can't remember the exact circumstances, but he's lived in the workhouse, but has then returned to live with his son, and it might be Vincent's family.
Yes, it would be Vincent, yeah.
And he has slept or fallen asleep on one of the children's beds. And apparently it sounds like his son, who worked shifts or nights or something, he was asleep in one bed. The father was going downstairs about to get dressed, got a bundle of clothes, and fell face down. And he was found dead, clutching his bundle of clothes. But the thing that struck me then, I didn't think too much about, it sounds really sad, about the anemia side. I just remember thinking, how cramped. He slept upstairs or something, and when one of the children had gone to school, he would then use a proper bed.
I think these people were living in circumstances that were unbelievably cramped and overcrowded. And, you know, we have so much space now.
I know, yes.
By comparison.
Yeah.
You know, our standards of living are so much higher.
Mm.
So there we've got, doesn't even have a bed to himself.
Yeah.
Overcrowding, poor food, over a very, very long period of time, even a spell in the workhouse.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I mean, it's amazing he lived to 73,
absolutely,
really, isn't it? I think we can imagine that his death would have been hard for his daughter, your great-grandmother, Eliza, as she had been married for less than 3 months at the time of his death. But as you could say, he was fortunate that he got to see his daughter married.
And for Eliza, I know more about her. She and Charles Bailey, her husband, they actually had their first child, I think it was about 3 months before they got married. So he will have known his grandson. And was his name Charles James Bailey?
That's right.
I think.
Yes. Just around the corner here, we're going to get to the National Trust's back-to-back.
Okay.
And we'll talk a bit more about Eliza and Charles there.
Okay, lovely, thank you. All right.
Wow. So atmospheric, isn't it?
It is indeed.
It's really evocative. So this is the courtyard of the back-to-backs. In this particular one we're standing in, they had about 60 people living in the 11 wow. houses, sharing four privies. And they tended to have their own a brew house that they would mm-hmm. share for washing as well.
It was a brewers.
A brewers.
A brewers.
I love the way you're getting yeah. me right on my pronunciation here. And so it tended to be families, but not just families, it would also be lodgers. Because okay. to make a bit more money, they would have lodgers, often sharing a children's room, actually, with a sort of curtain between them.
Yeah. It actually doesn't bear thinking about.
No, it doesn't really.
No.
But we've established that Eliza, your great-grandmother, had seen her father die in March of 1901, but 3 months before that had married another Charles Bailey, and they married on Christmas Eve. And one thing I should say is that it's actually quite common to marry on Christmas mm. Eve or Christmas Day. In fact, we know that in Birmingham, it was actually free to marry on
oh,
Christmas
really?
Day.
Yeah.
And of course, it's just because it's time off work. So we know another romantic detail, mm-hmm. and that is how Eliza and Charles met.
Okay.
They were neighbours.
I didn't know that.
So we have Charles living at number 38 New Bartholomew Street, okay. and Eliza at number 40.
Okay.
And Eliza was 17 and Charles was 19. So this is young love.
Absolutely.
Charles was working, I think you know, and as a motorcycle frame builder.
Yes.
And you said that Charles Bailey's a bit of a mystery to you. Is that right?
Yes. There doesn't seem to be a birth record for him. And if you look only for Charles, and at one point I went through every single Charles Bailey census record in Birmingham and then started going further out, there isn't a birth record or census record for him with his family. But there is a John Bailey Smith in 1881, who by 1891 seems to be called Charles Bailey. And the reason I say that is that in the 1881 census, he's got other siblings who also carry the Bailey Smith surname. But by the time of the 1891 census, they too become simply Bailey.
Well, you're onto something here. And also, am I right in thinking that you've done a DNA test to try and find out more?
Yes. I wanted to explore various routes, but particularly to do with Charles Bailey's line, because his parents were a mystery completely. And through DNA matching, I'm pretty sure there is a link with somebody called Betsy Coley, who I believe was Charles's mother. But there is confusion about his name.
Okay, so I think we can help. So you are right to be cautious. You have the great instinct of a historian there.
Thank
but
you.
But Betsy Coley, or Cooley, she's spelt as both in
okay.
the records.
Yeah.
Born 1839, is indeed Charles's mother.
Nice one.
So she first married Samuel Bailey in Wolverhampton in 1857. He was a stonemason.
Yeah.
And on the marriage certificate, neither Samuel nor Betsy could sign their names. Mm-hmm. They both make a mark. And over the next 15 years, they have 8 children.
Right.
So we've got Sarah, Hannah, Aaron, Jane, Betsy, Fanny, Mary and Samuel. And one other thing that's quite interesting is that they move very regularly. So we can see this from where the children are registered as being born. So we have them in Coles Hill, Conaton, Birmingham, Staffordshire, Wrexham, Warwickshire, all over the place. Mm. And I think it might be to do with Samuel's work. So as yeah. a stonemason, he's going wherever the jobs are. But he dies in 1872, mm-hmm. Having suffered for 6 months with stomach cancer.
Yeah.
Leaving Betsy with that huge family.
Mm. And all the children are alive at that point, are they?
All the children are alive at that point. Yeah. And a year later, she remarries. And she remarries a William Smith.
Right.
An engine fitter. And by 1876, we've got them living on Icknid Road on the edge of Edgbaston Reservoir, right here in the centre of Birmingham.
Oh, wow.
And they have a further four children, Ada, William, John, and Charles.
Okay.
So Betsy has had 12 children over 22 years. So she's been pregnant more or less every other year.
Wow.
So just think for poor old Betsy. And she is working soon after this as an occasional cook, but she starts to do that because some point between 1881 and 1891, William Smith, her second husband, mm-hmm. dies.
Well, I have not found any of this at all. So I've not found a marriage for her and William. That's interesting, actually, because from what I thought might be the case with the children she has, they seem to have the Smith surname, but then they go to the Bailey surname. Well,
exactly. That's where we're going next. So obviously, as a widow, she has to make ends meet. She's doing a bit of cooking. She has a lodger called Henry Staples. And as you say, bizarrely, in all the census records, the children she had by William Smith are listed under the surname of her first husband, Samuel Bailey. So the question is why? The birth records show that Charles and his siblings were given the middle name of Bailey and the surname Smith. And then later they gradually dropped the Smith. And the confusion carries on until Charles's marriage certificate when he lists his father as a portmanteau, as William Bailey, but his father had been William Smith and his mother's first husband had been Samuel Bailey. So I don't know if that's confusion from his point of view about the name, or if there's something else there. I wonder if we've got a, if this is romance really. I mean, Betsy has eight children by Samuel Bailey. She's married when she was 18, and then he dies and William Smith stands up, you know, steps up to the plate and looks after the children she has, and they have more children together. That after his death, she's reverted to the name of her first husband.
I see, yeah.
Suggests a kind of fondness for that lost...
Interesting.
Lost man. Yeah. So let's pick up with Charles Bailey then.
Yes.
So Charles Bailey... We think Charles enlists in the military in 1899.
Yes.
Just months before he's married to Eliza. And we found an article in the Police Gazette from June 1900 where he's charged with being absent from the militia.
I've seen this.
So having deserted.
Yeah. And doesn't it coincide with either the pregnancy or the birth?
Absolutely.
Of another of his children?
Well, it's of their first child.
Okay.
One nice thing about that, the Gazette, is that it lists that he has a tattoo with the name Eliza on his forearm.
Yes.
And so it seems likely that he left the military at that point because Eliza, his sweetheart, was about to have their first child, Charles. So their first child is Charles. They have him before they marry. They do marry. Mm-hmm. And indeed, they have five children by 1911. They're living in Birmingham, and in fact, she will go on to have had a total of nine children. Mm. It seems that three of them died young.
Yes.
We know of Henry, for example, dying in 1917 when he's 3 years old. Henry dies, we know from his death certificate, of marasmus. Mm-hmm. And this is a condition... This is heartbreaking. It's
really?
Caused by malnutrition.
Oh, wow.
Again, this points us to the reality of life in a back-to-back.
Absolutely.
You know, here we're now, and it's beautiful, and it looks very picturesque.
Yeah.
But actually, it was
different,
a very, very different way to live. Mm. And it was very difficult. It was unsanitary. They were ill-compensated for the hard work they did. Mm-hmm. They didn't have enough to eat and they didn't have the right stuff to eat. So Charles re-enlists in the First World War. He becomes a staff sergeant in the Royal Warwickshire Regiment and in the Royal Garrison, the artillery. He serves in France. And we know that he was injured.
Yeah, it's a gunshot wound, isn't
it? Gunshot wound in the hand.
Oh, wow. Wow.
So when he's discharged in 1919, it also notes that he's got rheumatism. And what I think is really interesting is that by 1921, they're back living on Great Lister Street in back-to-backs. And he's working once again as a cycle worker.
Yes.
He's working for F.E. Baker Limited, which is a British motorcycle engineer manufacturer. He's doing what he'd been doing 20 years earlier. You know, there's that sense of promise that the government's made that they're going to give all the veterans, you know, a good standard of living and look after them. And it doesn't happen. He's back where he was 20 years earlier. 2 years later, tragedy strikes. Eliza dies on the 19th of May, 1923, of pulmonary tuberculosis.
Right.
Again, another indicator of the realities of life.
Is that associated with their living conditions as well?
Damp, unsanitary conditions.
Oh, really?
Don't help with regards to TB.
Mm-hmm.
And Charles never remarries, and he lives on until 1948.
Yeah.
When he does pancreatic cancer. Let's talk a little bit about their children. So we've got Adelaide.
Yes,
of
that's
course,
my grandmother.
Your grandmother.
Yeah.
So she's married Stanley in 1933, the age of 22. Do you know about what happened in 1935 to Stanley?
So Stanley, my granddad.
Stanley, your granddad.
No.
Have a look at this. So,
oh, yes. Now, I found this recently.
It's an extraordinary story, isn't it? So, I mean, quite a traumatic incident. So Stanley, at this point, is working in City Transport as a bus conductor.
Yeah.
And a man holding a small dog under his arm on the edge of the bus. You remember those open buses at the end? And the dog has leapt off. And the bus is, the article tells us, going 29 miles per hour. Yeah. But the man jumps after the dog to try and catch him and misjudges his step and falls on his head and dies as a result. Yeah. And one of the witnesses is your grandfather because he sees all of this.
Yeah.
I have to say, since I read it, it's really stayed with me. I keep thinking about how you would do that. You'd jump that after your dog, wouldn't you? And yet what happens?
And so, to witness that as well.
Exactly, to witness something like that. It's in itself, I mean, a small measure of what his father-in-law had witnessed in the war, but nevertheless traumatic in itself.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, they had their two children, Stanley and Doris Adelaide.
Yeah.
And Adelaide, as you've just said, died like her mother before her of TB. But we are now in territory that you know. And so we have had the most extraordinary trail through your family history. It's been complex and fascinating, hasn't it?
Absolutely.
And you yourself were born at the Great Western Pub, which was on the corner of Camden Street and George Street West, which your parents ran from 1957 till about 61.
By 1961, we were living in back-to-backs.
And what do you remember from living in back-to-backs?
I remember the address, 2 back of 121 Berners Street. And I didn't know until fairly recently that living on the back was less prestigious. I remember it was small, but it was probably smaller than I recall it being.
Yes.
I remember the kitchen was tiny. I don't think you'd count it as a kitchen these days. I remember we didn't have lovely windows like these. We had a small flat window, smaller than this. And like these houses, there were two bedrooms and Mum and Dad were in the first bedroom. And then in the top bedroom, there were four of us sleeping top to tail in two single beds, which were quite close together. And I remember it being cold. We had a coal fire downstairs and that was it.
Yeah.
So I remember in winter, we were fascinated by Jack Frost's appearance. So all the lovely patterns on the windows. The icicles as a sort of slight thaw and then the freezing again. Some of the icicles were wonderful. They were so, so long.
You have to love the fact that a child interprets the privation of being so cold as look at the beauty of the icicles. Isn't that the wonder of children? Yeah,
but it really was. It was beautiful.
We had a power cut recently and my child complained that we had candles, and I said, we're living like kings.
We're living like... See, we didn't have candles, so definitely you were. Yeah.
Well, that brings us to the end of our stroll round Birmingham and its famous back-to-backs and the rich family that we've experienced from the Phillips and the Baileys What do you make of what you've learned?
I'm fascinated because what you've done and the Find My Past team is you fleshed out the people that I've seen as names and places, and you've brought them to life more. So it is lovely. It gives me more of a sense of them and the deprivation that they've experienced and the lives they've lived. I feel really humbled to know how they lived. And actually, I'm a descendant of theirs. And yeah, I'm proud of that. Thank you very much for everything that's been done.
Well, that's it for this episode of Step Into the Past. My thanks to Jan Daniels for being a fantastic guest. These back-to-back houses are cared for by the National Trust, and I do recommend that you come here next time you're in Birmingham to get a sense of what the past was really like. You can find out about all the information on this episode if you go to www.findmypast.co.uk, and you can get started on your own family tree. Where will your past take you? I'm Professor Susanna Lipscomb. It's been my pleasure to host this episode. Thank you for listening, and don't forget to hit follow wherever you get your podcasts so you'll know every time a new episode is released. I'll see you next time.